Order. It is Monday, a beautiful day in Oregon. It's 8:30 a.m. and I would like to open a public hearing on HCR 12 and Larry Galizio. Representative Larry Galizio. And this is a subcommittee, by the way, until I get the rest of my members here.
Good morning, Senator Ramon Sanderson, committee members. Larry Galizio, House District 35, and appreciate you taking the time for this. And in short, all of us are fortunate to have staff and legislative aides who help us out. And if all was right in the world, Logan Will would be sitting upstairs in my office right now as a staff member, but unfortunately he was killed in an automobile accident before Thanksgiving. And this bill or memorial is in honor of his life. He was an amazing young man. He worked in this building as an intern in my first legislative session in 2005, and he worked on my campaign, and he attended Willamette University right across the street, and he was a star debater, went overseas, represented the college, and was part of a championship team. He was a great young man, one of those sort of promising Oregonians who I have no doubt would be successful if he had chosen actually politics, which he was a political junkie. The guy could tell you anything about any policy. He was an incredible young man. So this, he also worked for college Democrats at Willamette and was just a great young man and part of our community. And so this was an attempt to honor his life and his service to Oregon. And on the House floor, we had a nice event, and his parents came. He was their only child, and so we were able to honor him. And so I would hope that this committee would see fit to continue to honor this great young man.
Thank you very much. This is always tough to deal with. Especially when it's a child. Any discussion? Would it be possible? I can't go into work session, but we will. And if you have testimony to share on the House floor, was there any written information on this young man that we could share? Or is it in the bill? Just a minute.
You know,
let me look.
Yeah, I think
probably in the bill.
Fortunately, there's some good information actually in the talks about his life in the resolution. So I think if on the Senate floor, on the House floor read one of the paragraphs because I thought it was quite good. So,
all right.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate
all right,
it.
We'll close the public hearing on HCR 12, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3290. And a Representative Greenlick. You're recuperating well.
Getting there.
But you should have a cane.
I took your advice and I wore the cane for 2 weeks after you instructed me to do so. And now I do it outside all the time, but I'm trying to.
Okay. I just don't want you to fall again.
I walk funny with the cane.
Thank you.
I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, and I appreciate you hearing House Bill 3290, sponsored by me and the chair. There are 57 hospitals in the state of Oregon, 55 of which are nonprofit institutions, and that nonprofit status comes from the U.S. Internal Revenue Code, Section 501c3, which requires C3 institutions to be eleemosynary institutions to deal with charitable care, research, and education when it's a hospital, medical education when it's a hospital. And the Oregon hospitals, I think, have done a pretty good job of doing that charitable care. But the fact is, there hasn't been any real way to know, because all the hospitals report their charitable care functions, their eleemosynary functions, in the bill we talk about community benefit functions, in a very different way. As any of you that have ever seen a hospital bill know, charges are mythical that you get on a hospital bill. You get the $12 aspirins and all the weird stuff, and those charges don't relate to what anybody pays or what hardly anybody pays. So the hospital association has been under some pressure over time to start reporting community benefit on a cost-based way. And House Bill 3290 is their response to those requests, to get a clear-cut picture of what the direct community benefit of each of the institutions is. The bill came sponsored by the Hospital Association, the Oregon Association of Hospital and Health Systems, and from work that was done jointly with the Hospital Association and with the consumer advocates to create a bill that that makes sense from the Hospital Association's perspective and from the perspective of the consumer advocates. The bill requires hospitals to report within 60 days after submitting the Medicare cost report, a report to the Office of Health Policy and Research that reports the direct community benefit on the basis of actual costs. And you'll see in the bill, it defines community benefit as charitable care, loss related to Medicaid, Medicare, and CHIP, community health improvements, research, and financial and in-kind contributions to the community, and community building activities affecting health in the community. The bill has no fiscal, because the Office of Health Policy and Research is required to report this data anyway, but they haven't had data that they could rely upon before, and they're very happy to see this coming so that they can begin to report data that makes some sense to the community rather than the weird stuff that had been coming to them before. And it passed in the House 58-0.
I'd like to applaud you and the Hospital Association, Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, for coming forward, because we struggled last session with, we call it our transparency bills, and I think this is a really good faith effort to start providing information to the public. Is there any discussion? Thank you, Representative Greenland.
Thank you very much.
Ellen Lowe and Scott Manchester.
Thank you, Tom. I'm Ellen Lowe, community advocate for and to the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And Chairman Sanderson, Senator Cruz, and Senator Courtney, I'm very pleased to appear before you on behalf of Oregon's 57 acute care community hospitals, healthcare systems, and the patients they serve. And I particularly appreciate your placing 3290 on your early agenda for acting upon House bills. I appear today to seek your support for the mandatory, consistent system of standards for reporting the community benefits these 57 hospitals extend to the communities they serve. while all these hospitals seek to honor their community obligations, there has not been a uniform standard for reporting these contributions. Oregon hospitals requested this mandatory system in order to be accountable, to be visible to their local constituencies. These assessments and reports will provide guidance for the healthcare community collaboratives that are developing in many sectors of Oregon. They will also serve you and your fellow state policymakers with clear information about the aggregate of Oregon's health-related strengths, needs, and responses, as well as the variations that are so very real within some of our cities and regions. This information will be of value to you as you make policy decisions. Its value has also been noted by the Oregon Health Policy Commission. The commission unanimously endorsed House Bill 3290, and you heard Representative Greenlick mentioned that with the exception of the absentees of Representative Galizio and Jensen, it passed unanimously on the House floor. The legislation was developed in consultation with the Oregon Health Action Campaign, and amendments were advanced before the House committee that gained OHAC's support. I trust that you are very familiar with the direct financial benefit a hospital provides to your home territory. Oregon hospitals employ approximately 55,000 people and make up 30% of the state's largest employers. These are family wage positions, but you may not be as aware that while a hospital is an economic engine within your wider community, it may be experiencing negative operating margins. The inclusion of Medicare and Medicaid statistics within the proposed reporting system will help explain some of these losses. Last year, the Medicare funding shortfall for Oregon hospital care exceeded $406 million. Medicare pays only 84 cents for each dollar spent caring for beneficiaries. Oregon hospitals receive an average of 73 cents for each dollar spent caring for Medicaid patients, and this shortfall for hospital care is approximately $194 million. When you can see the number of Medicare and Medicaid patients accessing your area hospitals, it will help explain the relative health of these institutions. And you will see that it isn't just the distance from another hospital or the size of the hospital, but also the populations they serve that influences the nature of community benefits that are developed. As I have had the opportunity to review many of the community benefits of Oregon hospitals, I've noted that most fall into the categories of prevention, early intervention, and communication, in addition to outreach to the uninsured. No Oregon hospital wants its emergency room to be the medical home for its neighbor population. Hospitals are part of the support networks for such services as prenatal care, medical homes for the uninsured, immunization clinics, zero premium health insurance for low-income uninsured children, transportation to services, safety net clinics. You can see more examples in the attachments. I also ask you to notice how many of these services involve collaboration with the public and private sectors and tax-exempt organizations. I anticipate that as this information is published, it will stimulate further community initiatives. It should also advance models that can be replicated elsewhere. The inclusion of financial assistance plans, charity care, will also broaden your knowledge of your communities and the economic health of the hospitals standing by to serve them. The guidelines for charity care established consistent and standardized eligibility criteria that address income levels, cultural accessibility, and consumer information while allowing for community needs. The inclusion of these policies should provide more visibility to their existence. All Oregon hospitals do have financial assistance policy with guidelines. The Oregon Office for Health Policy and Research, or OOPR, will be responsible for compiling the hospital information. They, by rule, will establish the format that will allow for a description of the hospital's community benefits for the previous fiscal year and assign and report the cost of community benefits provided during that period. OOPR will not have to start from scratch. The community benefit inventory for social accountability has been developed and it is being used in a number of Midwest systems. There will be no fiscal, as you heard from Representative Greenlick, because while much of this information is currently submitted to OOPR, the community benefits reporting system will allow the information to be submitted in a much more user-friendly format for consumers, for researchers, and for you. House Bill 3290A engrossed will enable the creation of a comprehensive, accountable system that will provide every community with full access to information on their hospital's contributions to meet local care needs. The reports will also provide a glimpse of the profile of the special needs populations as well as the uninsured. And the report should be instructive in illustrating how these challenges may be met in very disparate communities. This effort is meant to contribute to our knowledge base so our statewide policies can respect our many differences. And I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Have you worked with the Oregon Office for Health Policy and Research? Are they agreeable to this?
Mona Sanderson, yes, they are. They have been involved in discussions about the system and how it might be adapted to what's going on in Oregon. And so they are partners.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Manchester. I'm the helpline coordinator with the Oregon Health Action Campaign, and I'm pleased to be here this morning. OHAC supports the engrossed version of House Bill 3290. We believe this is a vital step towards understanding the value of the community benefits provided by Oregon hospitals, and we believe that those benefits are a critical part of the system that we have in Oregon today in terms of caring for the uninsured. My job with OHAC is helpline coordinator, and this is a toll-free number that consumers can call when they're having trouble accessing medical services, including trouble with paying for their hospital bills. So we hear a lot of anecdotal data from consumers about the problems that they've had with hospital bills. We hear about many of them who have been helped greatly by hospital financial assistance programs. We've also heard about consumers who have been challenged by the financial assistance process that hospitals have in place. This bill will give us more comprehensive data on what's actually going on and let the public, the policymakers, and advocates such as OHAC know about how we're funding care for the uninsured in Oregon. The sorts of questions that we hope this bill will help us answer are how many hospital patients are uninsured, occurred? How do they break out in terms of inpatient and outpatient settings? How many total requests are there for charity care or financial assistance? And what's the income level of those applicants? How many are of those applications are approved? How many are denied? One of the changes that were made in the amendments adopted on the House side were the addition of a provision that says that the reporting system will be consistent with established national standards for hospital reporting and community benefits. Our understanding is that the intent of this is that we will be using national standards called the CHA Community Benefit Reporting Guidelines, so that we will be able to look at charity care and financial assistance on an apples-to-apples basis, which we're currently unable to do. Another of the issues that Ellen alluded to was Medicare reimbursement. We have heard that hospitals often receive Medicare reimbursement that is less than the cost of providing the Medicare benefit. One of our concerns is that if hospitals that hospitals should not count Medicare benefit as a community benefit, as basically charity care, but that discussion about how exactly to handle that could be much better informed if we had data about our hospitals making money, losing money, exactly what sorts of funding is involved in terms of Medicare benefits. So again, this is an area where we hope that 3290 will allow for a better informed public policy process about how we are dealing with the uninsured in Oregon. And we therefore support the bill, and we encourage you to pass it out with a due pass recommendation.
Any discussion? I appreciate the example of Legacy Mount Hood Medical Center at Gresham. It's nice to know we have not, we've had the public health, a primary, an FQHC, federally qualified health center through Multnomah County, but we haven't really had a free clinic, and Wallace Medical Concern is just starting up a free clinic in the Rockwood area, and I'm very excited about that. And I appreciate the support that Legacy Mount Hood Medical Center has certainly given to them. Okay, any other further discussion? With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3290, and I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 3290.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3290 to the floor of the Senate with a due 3298, excuse me, to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves that House Bill 3290A be moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. I'd like to open a work session on HCR 12. And I'm carrying the bill.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd like to open a work session on HCR 12. Colleagues, we had a public hearing on this, and it memorializes the life of Logan Layton Will, who worked for Representative Galizio and was unfortunately killed in an accident while heading home to Grants Pass over the Thanksgiving holidays. So we're in work session for HCR 12. Yes.
Move HCR 12 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Carter moves HCR 12 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered, and I'll carry that bill also. And I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2773. Representative Kotek.
Good morning, Chair Mazza and members of the committee. I hope you all had a good weekend. For the record, my name is Tina Kotek, State Representative for House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. This morning I'm before you to urge your support of House Bill 2773, which I'm co-sponsoring with your wonderful chair. This is a bill to set up an 8-member task force in the department, with the support of the Department of Education, to look at the state of school nurses here in Oregon. We know that the link between health and learning is critical. We all know that, at least from our own childhoods, we remember the school nurses who made sure that we were taken care of when things came up. Unfortunately, today we don't have the number of school nurses that we need in the schools. But before we can even talk about expanding what we're doing in the state, we really need to look at the problem. And that's what this bill is about. So set up a task force, get some people around the table to look at how we're doing in terms of our school nurses here in the state, what's our ratio, what are the schools doing, what are their funding issues, and then make some recommendations in the interim to see how we go forward. This bill had unanimous support in both the Health Policy Subcommittee on the House side and the full House Committee on Health Care, and did very well on the floor. There were a few no votes. I think there were some concerns about some states actually mandate school nurses in every school. This bill is not saying we do that. This bill says we should look at that issue, and maybe that's where we want to go, but it's about figuring out the plan to get us to stronger levels of school health services in terms of our nurses in the schools. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions. Very straightforward bill, and I hope you all support it.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Representative Kotek. This has been a problem. We have always tried to get information from the Department of Ed regarding the number of school nurses, who takes care, who monitors the medications, the qualifications, how many health aides are there, and they have never been able to give us that information. And so hopefully with this study group, I'm very hopeful that we will now be able to start getting a better idea of the healthcare status, or at least for healthcare givers in the schools. Is there discussions on this? Yes, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm looking at this task force is tasked with the responsibility of coming back with recommended plan to establish school nurses as a mandated service, and I'm hoping we're not looking at saying we have to have a nurse in every school in any of this. I'm looking at rural Oregon and collaboration with public health and other collaborative entities to make sure it's access and not just, I mean, it shouldn't become strictly a staffing issue. From my perspective, bigger schools are clearly a different animal. But when you have a school district with 120 students, making that a mandatory position inside the school may cost a teacher or something like that. So, just noting a concern.
Chair Moss Anderson and Senator Cruz, I think that's an excellent observation. Not every school district has the capacity. Currently, nationally, there's only one state. It's the state of Delaware, which, if you've been to Delaware, you can walk across the state of Delaware. It's very small. that actually mandates it in each school. And I think that's why we need a study group to look at what works for Oregon. There are national ratios saying there should be one school nurse for every 750 students. Well, what does that look like in rural Oregon?
Yeah.
We don't know. So I think that's a really excellent point. I'm hoping that's the work group's going to look at all those angles.
And there are partnerships. I was the school nurse for Oregon City High School back in the late 80s, and I was actually a public health nurse at the same time. And so the nexus between the high school as well as the public health department worked very well. They had also one school nurse. I was the clinic nurse for the clinic that was there for, I forget how many schools they have, 14, 15 schools and many 8,000 students, one school nurse to take care of. And there are many medically fragile students in our school system that require a nurse to set up protocols in order to serve them while they are in the school system. So I'm just amazed at what our schools are doing now in juggling all that they have to do with especially those of our medically fragile students that, and they are mainstreamed. in. I know at Clear Creek Medical School, you go in and you see these students on the floor. They virtually cannot move, and they have aides helping to turn them and feed them and that type of thing. So it's amazing the types of students we have in our school system.
Absolutely,
yes. Senator Carter, you had a question?
It was asked by Senator Cruz.
Oh, okay.
Question.
Yes.
Thank you, and good morning, Representative Kotek. Could you talk about the relationship of the task force and the study to the existing school-based health centers and what your hope is with regard to the relationship?
Chair Monica Anderson and Senator Gourley, again, another excellent question. I think what I like to look at is the continuum of school health services. Not every school or school district has the capacity to have a school-based health center. We have about 45 across the state, primarily in larger school districts. And some schools have both. They have school nurses and school-based health centers. And honestly, that's ideal because the school nurses will be that first stop for a child. They can refer them into the community. They could refer them into their primary care setting in the school, the school-based health centers. But ideally, you have both because the school nurse is a public health nurse. They're dealing with the children with specific medical needs on a daily basis. They're also making sure children have some of the other of their other health needs met. And if they have primary care needs, they send them to the clinics. And so there's been a lot of attention in the state on school-based health centers, which I think is appropriate. But there's this assumption that school nurses and centers are the same things. Some schools, what they need is a school nurse. They're never going to have the capacity for a clinic, a full-blown clinic. But having that school nurse to help them maybe refer them to their rural health clinic or to other services in the community is very important. So it's really trying to understand that relationship, I think, it would be a good outcome from the report to clarify that for a lot of folks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes, Chair, maybe just another point, because Representative Kotek referenced the fact that sometimes it's tough to get information out of ODE. I would say most of the time it is. And so I do sympathize with that perspective. It's much more global than just this issue. But I would suggest that it might be appropriate because this task force is supposed to report September 1st, 2008, and I would suggest that if and when we have our special session in February, we might want to bring them in and get kind of a flavor of progress at that point.
Mm-hmm. Chair Monica Anderson, Senator Cruz, I think it's a great idea, especially for a lot of the task forces that we're going to be sending off in the interim. But this,
That doesn't need to be in the bill. It just needs to be something that the committees will request.
So noted.
Yeah, thank you.
So. Is there any other further discussion on this bill? All right, with that, I'll close the... Oh, wait, before I do that, is the Department of Ed here at all? Anyone from the Department of Ed? Have you talked with the Department of Ed?
Chairman Sanderson, we have. We've had email exchanges. They're neutral on the bill. They're willing to help out.
Okay. And I know the fiscal... there would not be a fiscal that I'm aware of. Okay. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2773, and I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2773.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2773 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gourley moves House Bill 2773 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered, and I'll carry this one, too. All right, what do we have left? We have this one. Okay, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2154. Heather Patanner, did I say it right? Cindy Smith, and is it Cameron Campbell?
Good morning, Chair Monica Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Heather Hutanen. I'm the training director for the Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force. And because this is my first time testifying before this committee and Attorney General Hardy Myers was unable to be here this morning, I'd like to just spend a few minutes giving you a framework for the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. Attorney General Hardy Myers initiated the task force in 1999, and we currently have about 225 Oregonians representing a broad continuum of disciplines, victim advocates, law enforcement, civil legal attorneys, medical professionals, mental health workers, and prosecutors who participate on the task force and its committees. Attorney General Myers chairs the task force, and we meet approximately every 6 weeks in Salem to address a whole continuum of business specifically associated with the issue of sexual assault. Our mission is to improve the response to sexual assault and reduce the incidence of sexual assault in Oregon. And so to that end, we address training and education. We do prevention work. We provide technical assistance statewide. And then we also do legislative public policy work. And that is why I'm before you today. House Bill 2154, A. Engrossed, was requested by the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force under the auspices of the Oregon Department of Justice. So I'm here this morning to offer testimony in support of House Bill 2154, A. Engrossed. The intent of House Bill 2154, A. Engrossed, is to eliminate the requirement for law enforcement authorization prior to the collection of the Oregon State Police Sexual Assault Forensic Evidence Kit, otherwise known as a SAFE kit. This will be done by modifying what is called the SAVE Fund, which was put into law in 2003. The SAVE Fund is the Sexual Assault Emergency Medical Response Fund for victims, and that pays for the medical examination, the collection of evidence, sexually transmitted infection prophylaxis, and emergency contraception prophylaxis for victims in Oregon. So what we would like to do is modify the SAVE Fund so that eligibility requirements will now be increased to include that victims can be offered the Oregon State Police SAFE kit without having to report to law enforcement. For all practical purposes, what that will look like is that victims who respond to a medical facility within 84 hours after the sexual assault would have the opportunity to either report to law enforcement if they were ready and willing to do so, and if not, they could either have just the medical exam and the prophylaxis administered to them if they so chose, or in addition to that would also have the option of having that evidence collection piece conducted. What we're seeing across the nation is that approximately 31 states in the U.S. currently have laws on the books that are very similar. They have provisions for evidence collection without law enforcement reporting, and the reason for that is that we see within populations of victims or other folks who have suffered traumatic experiences that very often people aren't in a position to make immediate decisions about, do I want to prosecute, do I want to report and tell my story to a law enforcement officer I've never met, do I know how the system works, am I ready to make these decisions. What we find is that victims very often change their mind a couple weeks, sometimes a couple months down the road. Particularly, we see victims where they become aware that someone else has also been victimized by the same person are really wanting to come forward. So for that purpose, we're calling this the Evidence Preservation Bill, because it would really enable the criminal justice system to collect that evidence when it's available, which is immediately following the assault, capture and hold it, and then thereby preserving not only the options for the victim, but preserving options for the criminal justice system, so that should that victim then come forward to report, the criminal justice system would be in a better position to move forward on their part.
Where is that evidence kept?
Chairman Anderson, the evidence right now is currently kept within law enforcement agencies, and that is what is also outlined in the bill. It is law enforcement agencies that already have systems for evidence lockers and logs. They have evidence staff, and there's already court systems in place that designate how evidence shall be collected and maintained and the chain of evidence. And so we would certainly, the bill certainly reflects compliance with all of those systems.
So a person would be victimized, and then they would go, they wanted to would they go to a hospital?
Yes. Chair Monis Anderson, just for all practical purposes, what it sort of looks like on face is a victim will report or come to a hospital medical facility. Let's say they've had no contact with anyone and they're going, they're concerned a pregnancy or a sexually transmitted infection, and they show up and the hospital staff say, okay, here are your options. There's a fund that will pay for your medical exam. You can have evidence collected if you like. Let's say that they choose this option, not to report and have evidence collected. What that would mean is that the hospital would then collect that evidence and put an anonymous number on that safe kit, the sexual assault forensic evidence kit, and then law enforcement, just as they already do, would come to the hospital, pick up that evidence, and then log it into their evidentiary system. So the same system would be in place. We would just be providing for some kits where the victim's name would not be known to law enforcement at that time, but should they come forward, they would then have a mechanism to do so.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. How long is this evidence kept now? And number one and number two, why 6 months? I mean, because you're talking about they may have a change of heart, and they may find there are other victims which would compel them. Why 6 months and not a year?
Okay. Senator Monis Anderson, Senator Cruz, the reason that we selected 6 months was to start off with sort of a balance in working with law enforcement and prosecutors off this, throughout the state. What we found in working with them is that in terms of delayed reporting, that victims were most often coming in under that six-month time period for victims who decided to report. The other thing was that particularly for some of the larger law enforcement agencies, what we wanted to do was give them a sense that the amount of evidence would not be overwhelming to them. So let's say specifically the Portland Police Bureau, we didn't want them to feel like they would then have to build new evidence lockers to deal with this. I think that certainly our hope is that after we initiate this public policy, it will really give us an opportunity to see how the system works and what the amount of evidence is really going to look like. We don't anticipate an enormous change, but I think that we need to be able to give law enforcement some sense that they're not going to be seeing a huge influx.
The other part was current practice. How long is this anonymous information kept? I mean, because I'm assuming law enforcement gets a kid and they don't, well, there's no name and they throw it out. I don't think they do that, so.
Right. Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Cruz, right now there is no mechanism in sexual assault for holding what we could call anonymous kits. As you know, there are systems for other kinds of crimes, like Jane Doe, and they have a system where they initiate a report that is, it could be anything. It could be a criminal misconduct. It could be a Jane Doe report. Some agencies have that. And so what we believe will happen is we give a guideline for 6 months, and that there will be agencies that will keep these safe kits for an indefinite period of time, and then there will be agencies where they've identified that they have limited storage space, and they will destroy the evidence through whatever practices are already established for evidence disposal in Oregon, because as you know, once a criminal case has been completed, most often that evidence is destroyed. So there are systems in place for that.
Thank you.
I know, if you ever watch Cold Case, they have rows and rows of boxes of evidence. Guess that doesn't happen here. Yeah, any other questions regarding this?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'm just curious about
Has this bill been heard by the Judiciary Committee? Either side?
Chair Monis-Anderson, Senator Gordley, it has not. Mm-hmm. It was heard in the Women's Health and Wellness Committee on the House side and then passed very strong in the House chamber.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Monis-Anderson and committee members. My name is Cindy Smith, and I'm a nurse practitioner and a certified sexual assault nurse examiner at the University of Oregon Health Center. Our health center is one of the only a few programs in the country that have a trained sexual assault nurse examiner on staff to collect forensic evidence from a sexual assault victim. We developed our program after years of caring for sexual assault victims that came to us because they did not want to be seen in the emergency room and had not yet made a decision about reporting to law enforcement. Last year, we saw 13 sexual assault cases, 10 of which did not want to report to law enforcement at the time of their initial visit. This academic school year, we have seen 12 sexual assault cases, 6 of which did not want to report at the time of their initial exam. It is not uncommon for us to later hear that one of these students would now like to report the sexual assault to law enforcement. For example, this past October, I saw a student who was raped by a stranger in an alley while walking home from a friend's house. It was her friends that called the clinic and brought her in, as she could not even talk on the phone to make the appointment. She arrived at the clinic within several hours of the assault, not having showered and with the clothes she had worn at the time of the assault in a bag. All of these very helpful steps in being able to best collect and preserve evidence. During the interview, it was so upsetting and painful for her to tell me the details of the assault that when I informed her that to collect an evidence kit, I would need to involve law enforcement, she declined to go forward with that part of the exam. I cannot fully express to you how frustrated I felt that day, not with the victim, but rather with the system, knowing that as I did the rest of her medical exam, I could not collect forensic evidence at the same time, and that any evidence would now be lost forever. I realized at the time that it took all the courage this student had to even come to our clinic, let alone make a decision about involving law enforcement. Unfortunately, a week later, I saw the same student back for a follow-up visit, and it was then that she said she would like to see, she would like to follow up, excuse me. Unfortunately, a week later, I saw the same student back for a follow-up visit, and it was then that she said she would like to not see what happened to her happen to someone else, and that now she would like me to help her get in contact with law enforcement. This is not an unusual situation when it comes to a sexual assault follow-up at our clinic. We developed our program with every intention of being able to collect evidence in a timely manner and allow the victim an opportunity to consider all their options. The current requirement for law enforcement authorization to collect a sexual assault forensic kit is by far the biggest obstacle we face in having a successful sexual assault nurse examiner program in our clinic. I thank you for your time, and I do urge you to support House Bill 2154.
Thank you for your very, very important and relevant testimony.
Chair Monis-Anderson, members of the committee, I did have one additional point that I wanted to make, which is that the Office for Victims of Crime administers the Federal Violence Against Women Act dollars to all 50 states, as you may already know. Oregon, of course, is one of these recipients. And it was just this year that they changed their requirements for federal VAWA dollars for all states and territories. The requirement now includes that all state or territory government entity incurs the full out-of-pocket expense for forensic medical exams for victims of sexual assault, which I'm very pleased to say has already been covered by the SAVE Fund passage in 2003. However, it makes an additional requirement, which is that by January 5th of 2009, all states and territories will have to certify that they do not require victims of sexual assault to participate with or cooperate with law enforcement or the criminal justice system in order to receive medical forensic services. So I just wanted to share that with you in keeping with some of the federal legislation that's coming down. We have a window in which to accomplish this, and I think that I was very excited to see that we had just decided to move this bill forward, and then as it turned out, the federal VAWA requirements were asking for us to do so as well. I wanted to share that.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you.
Madam Chair, yes.
Senator Gordley.
Could you address the amendment that we have that's dated March 15th? Lines 9 through 11, which are repeated again in lines 15 through 17. These were the House amendments.
They were incorporated into the main, so it would be the A engrossed.
Do you have that?
Okay, so that language is now on page one of the bill.
Chair Montes-Anderson, Senator Gordley, this line, thank you so much for pointing that out. This is actually in order to be in compliance with the federal food and drug regulation guidelines that now say that emergency contraception can be administered to women who are 18 years and above without a prescription. And so the reason that we have it specified 17 years of age or younger is so that we're specifically in compliance with FDA guidelines. Okay. So before it said that all women, regardless of age, would need to get a prescription in order to receive EC, emergency contraception. And now in keeping with federal guidelines, we're saying that women who are 18 years and above do not need a prescription, while women who are 17 years and younger still will need a prescription for emergency contraception.
And again, these are FDA guidelines. Okay.
And that was August of 2006 that those guidelines were passed. And now emergency contraception is available over the counter nationwide.
All right. Thank you for clarifying that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other further discussion? Is Cameron Campbell?
He indicated that he would be here this morning, but it appears that he's been delayed.
Okay. All right. Any other discussion?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley had asked why this was not before Judiciary Committee, which is a reasonable question. And I'd just say that as a member of the Judiciary Committee, I think we would be doing the same thing with this bill that this committee is going to be doing with it. I think this makes a lot of sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2154A and open a work session on House Bill 2154A.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2154A to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Yes. Senator Gordley moves House Bill 2154A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. Who would like to carry this? Yeah. Senator Gordley would like to carry this bill. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2154. A and open a public hearing on HCR 7, and we have Preston Pulliams and Andrea Henderson.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May I start the testimony?
Please introduce yourself, yes.
All right. Again, good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Preston Pulliams. I'm District President of Portland Community College. First of all, I want to express my appreciation for this opportunity to express on behalf of our staff, our faculty, our foundation, our board of directors, and many others their wholehearted support for HCR 7. In memory of our friend and colleague, Doreen Margolin. I first met Doreen about 4 years ago at a national convention in Denver, where she was testifying and attending a national conference on community college issues. I was immediately impressed by her vitality, by her energy and commitment to the mission of community colleges. and also her love of Oregon, which she spent a lot of time talking with me about my need to visit this wonderful state. Doreen Margolin made a significant lasting contribution to local community college, to our local community college, and she also worked tirelessly at the state and national level for all institutions. Her commitment to community college dates back some 20 years. In 1986, Doreen was appointed as one of the very first board members of our newly formed PCC Foundation. She served as chair, and she was instrumental in setting the pace for the foundation for giving and donating annually for the last 20 years for scholarships and library funds. After her death, in accordance with her wishes, her family established the Doreen Margolin Scholarship Fund for single mothers attending our college, assuring that her memory will live with our students for a very long time. Doreen was appointed to our board of directors in 1999, ran successfully for that post twice following her appointment. Shortly after appointment to the board, Doreen was asked to chair the OCCA board from 2000 to 2002, a post which she held with great distinction. On a national level, Doreen was elected to the board of directors for the National Association of Community Colleges in 2003. Doreen chaired the PCC board 2002 to 2003 and until 2006, until her death. She guided the board with intelligence, insight, good spirit, and she was dedicated to the college and regularly attended the college functions, both large and small, formal and informal. She was a known and welcome presence at all PCC campuses, especially caring and expressing her care about students and how they were doing. All of us at Portland Community College miss Doreen's leadership, her friendship, caring, and commitment to the college. She was indeed a true friend. Her personality and presence remains with us, and we're grateful to have known her. We appreciate also legislators' willingness to honor her through a memorial resolution. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Andrea Henderson, Executive Director of the Oregon Community College Association. Thank you very much for this opportunity to hear this bill today. Doreen Margolin was a very important person in community colleges in Oregon, was a tremendous leader and just fearless advocate on behalf of community colleges. She was my board chair when I first started in my job, was an amazing leader, mentor, and friend. She was very instrumental both on the state level and the national level for community colleges and had an amazing presence that once you met Doreen, you could never forget her. She brought her leadership and her energy to many issues and is very instrumental in making it both our association and community colleges what they are today. We will miss her greatly, and thank you very much again for this opportunity to honor her life. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any discussion? All right. With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on HCR 7. I'd like to open a work session on HCR 7.
Madam Chair, I move HCR 7 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gorley moves HCR 7 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. And since it's Portland Community College, which Senator Carter will carry the bill. With that, I'll close the work session on HCR 7, and we're adjourned.